1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 12, and we'll be dealing with 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, 12 through 15 today, but I'm going to go ahead and read 12 through 22, rather, since we'll be dealing with that over the next three Sundays in somewhat of a mini-series. The Word of God says, "And we beseech you, brethren, to know them which labor among you, and are over you in the Lord, and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake, and be at peace among yourselves. Now we exhort you, brethren, warn them that are unruly, comfort the feeble-minded, support the weak, be patient toward all men. See that none render evil for evil unto any man, but ever follow that which is good both among yourselves and to all men. Rejoice evermore, pray without ceasing, and everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you. Quench not the spirit, despise not prophesyings, prove all things, hold fast that which is good, abstain from every appearance of evil." Let's go before the Lord in prayer. Father, I come before you this morning. I thank you for your goodness. I thank you for your beauty. I thank you for your word. I thank you for the opportunity to preach that word to your people. You know my weakness, Father. You know that I have nothing to offer to these people that are your people, and your word is the only thing that can benefit them. And I pray, Father, Lord, that your word would go forth this morning with clarity, and that you would grant understanding, and that you would be glorified, and your people would be edified. In Christ's name I pray, amen. Please be seated. Moving to a new place means learning new things. And by God's grace, I've learned a few things over the past year now that I've been here at Westside. Well, the basics of living life and ministering to God's people are much the same all over the world, and it's those very basics that we're going to be focusing on for the next 3 weeks. Some things are different from place to place. I've learned, for instance, that the weather forecast on my phone is about as reliable as the predictions of political pollcasters. Living in the Seattle area, it can rain at any time, anywhere, without any warning. Regardless of how sunny the weather was predicted to be, and even while the sun is still shining, it can rain. I've learned that contrary to what I had thought before, the world does not stop spinning each time the order of service is changed. Structure is still important. I'm thankful that we do have a certain degree of structure. But I've learned that flexibility in that structure isn't quite as earth-shattering as I used to think that it was. I've learned it's a little bit different than the former mentality that I'd had, and I'm adapting to that. I've also learned that before I get up to preach, the wonderful servants in the sound booth are going to ask me for a sermon title. Now, before I came here, titles were just not something that I did. The title of each of my sermons was the text of that sermon, and that was that. That's how I titled them on my computer. That's what I would title them, and who needs a title for a sermon? If you have the text, you have the title. That was the way that I thought about it. That just isn't the way that it works here. Titles are expected, and not just for the sound booth. In fact, Brother John wanted a title for my series over 2 weeks before the first sermon, just in order to put it in the bulletin. I struggled to think of one. As I'll be preaching three sermons from 1 Thessalonians 5, 12 through 22, my first thought was an exposition of 1 Thessalonians 5, 12 through 22. You have a title for the series. For some reason, Brother John didn't find that catchy or graphical enough. And my amazing idea of getting a screenshot of a manuscript of that passage of scripture just didn't really seem to flow for the bulletin. Maybe a bit too busy or something like that. I tried again. What about a mini-series on 1 Thessalonians 5, 12 through 22? That still didn't seem to be the ticket, so I kept trying. A summary of community. Well, that was too vague. Three-dimensional community was too buzzwordy, and if possible, even vaguer. And so it went. And so I got some help from Brother John to come up with a title. And the title that I did come up with, it seemed more or less satisfactory, is How God Does Church. I like the title we came up with. I hope you do too. It was a lot of work, and it sounds cool. And I like the graphic that Brother John developed. It looks great in the bulletin. Yet as much as I love the title that took so much effort, if you want to know what I will actually be preaching on for the next 3 weeks, the answer is quite simple, 1 Thessalonians 5, 12 through 22. The choice of text came before the series. When I first began to think about preaching from this text, I had a quite different message in mind. But as I studied, I soon realized that the exciting message about God's will in the life of the Christian that I had in my mind wasn't exactly the message that Paul had in his mind through the inspiration of the Spirit when he wrote to the Thessalonians. So I decided to ditch my idea and stick with Paul. And what Paul is writing about in this passage, though it's not immediately apparent as I began to study it, I began to realize what Paul is writing to the Thessalonians about is how God does church. The book of 1 Thessalonians is one of the very earliest, if not the earliest, depending on what dating, how you date Galatians, of the letters of Paul. Written around 50 AD, about 20 years or so after the death of Christ, was sent by the Apostle Paul to a small and struggling group of believers in the city of Thessalonica, known today as Thessaloniki. Thessalonica, the capital of the province of Macedonia, was one of the 10 largest cities in the Roman Empire, and easily the most prosperous city in the region of Macedonia. It was a religiously pluralistic city, one in which many gods were worshipped, and the worship of these many gods was tightly connected to the political, social, and economic life of the city. It was an important city, and its citizens were proud of that importance. After his release from imprisonment in Philippi, the famous story of the Philippian jailer, Paul visited this city, spending 3 weeks preaching in the synagogue and an unspecified, though certainly brief, time of additional ministry in the city and other venues. He could not have been there for more than 4 months at the max, and possibly not much longer than 4 weeks. It was a very brief visit. Some believed his radical message that Jesus was the promised Messiah. Others were angered by it. They gathered a mob, made some false accusations, and got Paul and Silas kicked out of town long before they were done, instructing the new community of Christ followers that was just beginning to gather around them. It was a difficult situation. Paul had a deep love for the infant church at Thessalonica and longed to return to finish his instruction of the believers there. But the circumstances of his departure, his friends actually had to give bail that Paul would be gone and stay gone. That was what was going on in this story in Acts. And so the circumstances of his departure meant it would be some time before it was safe for him to revisit them, if indeed he ever would be able to. We know he had some interaction with believers from Thessalonica, but the book of Acts doesn't say if he ever actually got to visit the church again, and certainly it would be some time before he was able to, if indeed he ever was able to. So concerned was he for their spiritual health, he had had to leave them so soon, so early on in their walk with the Lord, that he was willing to be left in the great city of Athens alone, something he almost never was willing to do, to be left alone by himself in the city of Athens, so that Timothy, who had not been implicated in the earlier disturbances, though from all appearances he had been present, he had been there with Paul, but he had not been one of the ones that had come to the attention of the authorities. And so Paul sent Timothy back to Thessalonica so that he could bring Paul news about the believers in Thessalonica and could establish them in the faith. The news that Timothy brought back was, for the most part, encouraging. Not only were the tidings concerning their faith and charity good, but they also desired to see the Apostle Paul again almost as much as he desired to see them. There were still things they did not understand. They were, after all, still very young in the faith. While some of them were converted out of the synagogue, Paul's testimony of them that they had turned to God from idols makes it clear that the majority of them were converts from the pervasive paganism that surrounded them, very new to the things of the Lord. So Paul, only about 6 months after his all too short stay in the city, and one of the things that's remarkable about the book of 1 Thessalonians, not only is it one of the earliest of Paul's letters, but it's also the letter that, to all appearances, is sent the briefest amount of time from Paul's visit to Paul's letter. So it's less than 6 months, according to the best chronological calculations of those who give their lives to such matters, that Paul's in Thessalonica, he leaves, and just a very short time later, he's writing them a letter very shortly after he established the church. And he writes this young church a letter in order to perfect what was wanting in their faith. In this letter, which we now know as 1 Thessalonians, Paul addressed several topics. After giving the bulk of the first three chapters to a review of his relations with the Thessalonians, reminding them of what it had been like when they first turned from idols to serve the living God, he moved on to more specific admonitions and instructions. He reminded them that God's will for them was their sanctification, which included strict sexual purity. He was encouraged by their devotion to brotherly love, but urged them to increase in it more and more. He encouraged them to avoid troublemaking of all kinds and to lead lives of quiet and generous diligence. He gave them instruction in the future hope of believers and in the coming day of the Lord more generally. He exhorted them to walk as the children of light that they were. At the end of the letter, starting in chapter 5 and verse 12, he gave them a series of commands that at first glance appear to be a somewhat random collection. Indeed, until I studied the passage, that is how I had always taken it. Yet upon further study, this string of imperatives is anything but random. It is, in fact, a summary of God's plan for the local church, a miniature description of the essentials of biblical community. It tells us, in brief, how God does church, which is, of course, the pattern that we at Westside desire to follow as well. Though our circumstances are very different from that of the infant church in Thessalonica, the foundational principles with which Paul instructed this church remain just as relevant to us today as they were when Paul first wrote them. As we go through the text, I'll be drawing to a greater extent than I normally would on truths that are found in other texts, particularly in the pastoral epistles, to round out the summary that we find here. I won't always be referencing, here's the particular verse in which this is found, but if you'll notice, there'll be some references to other scriptures as well. While I will be sticking with the basic structure found in this text and not attempting anything like a systematic theology of life and ministry in the local church, I'm only going to be preaching, Lord willing, for 3 weeks after all. I do hope that by the time we finish this series, all of us will have a clearer vision of the foundational principles of the life and community that is God's plan for each local church. As we begin this new year, my prayer is that God would inspire each of us with a passion to match both our vision and practice of life in the local church for God's plan for it. Well, by God's grace, I believe that we are already practicing many of the truths we will be covering. They are so foundational to how the church is to function that they cannot be revisited too often. So this isn't like, here's everything that's wrong with our church, and now I finally have the opportunity to address it because I really need 3 weeks to talk about everything that's wrong in the church. That's not the idea that I'm trying to get across. But here are the foundational principles of how the church is to operate. Here are some of the basics that Paul reiterated to this new church that we cannot revisit too often because you can never get beyond the need to revisit the basics. And the beginning of a new year is the perfect time to do that. So I'm just really thankful for how this all worked out because I wasn't originally even planning to preach on this topic. I was planning to preach on a different topic from this passage, but the passage forced me to change the topic. And then it just happened that it was at this time. And I believe the Lord worked it all out, and so we'll see how it goes. But with that in mind, let us return to the text that we read and revisit once again Paul's message to the Thessalonians about God's plan for ministry in the local church. Paul begins with some instruction about leadership in the local church, teaching the Thessalonian believers about the function that the ministers of the congregation have in the way the church is intended to function. Verse 12, and we beseech you, brethren, to know them. The first thing he says about this leadership is to exhort the brethren, which by no means excludes the sistern, as has sometimes been jokingly said. In other words, the members of the congregation as a whole. He's addressing the Thessalonian congregation, and he's saying, I want you to know a certain group of people who, from the description that is given of them, which we will return to in a minute, are clearly the leaders of the congregation. Now, what is it that Paul is wanting the congregation to do exactly? It is not as though the Thessalonian church was so big that the members were in danger of forgetting the names of their leaders. So what is he talking about? Some have suggested, and some Bibles have even translated it this way, the word literally means to know, that Paul is telling them, what he's telling them to do is to respect these leaders. Yet while Paul would have certainly wanted the leaders of the church to be respected, in the very next verse, he tells the congregation to esteem these leaders, which would seem to mean about the same thing as respect, making it, in my view, unlikely that he means the same thing when he tells them to know the same group in verse 12. There's actually a good deal of disagreement, even among faithful scholars, as to what exactly Paul intends in this verse. But in my view, the key is to consider the history of the Thessalonian church up to this point. The church was less than a year old, may have been only about 6 months old. This is a brand new church in which the majority of converts had come out of paganism. And most of the believers in the church had known the Lord for an even shorter time than Paul had first been there, because some of them had been converted at the end of his ministry there. This is a very young church. There had not, in the few short weeks that Paul had spent in Thessalonica, been time for a formal leadership structure to be set up in the way that it later would be. There had not been, up to this point, time for elders to be fully tested and formally appointed. Yet even at this early stage, there were already men in the church who were taking on leadership roles. What the congregation as a whole needed to do was to recognize or acknowledge these men as the leaders that they were. In other words, what Paul is telling the Thessalonians to do was to publicly acknowledge, both verbally and in practice, the leaders that God had given them as the leaders that God had given them. He does not refer to this group of leaders by the titles such as the elders or the bishops, titles that he uses in his other epistles, for the simple reason that these leaders did not yet have any formal title. They had not yet been officially recognized. In fact, setting them apart in a more formal fashion by the use of such titles, by the use of a particular office, was, in my view, a good part of what Paul was asking them to do. And this isn't an opinion that's original to me or my view alone as opposed to the whole rest of the world. It's actually a fairly common view of a couple of what Paul is intending in this passage, and I think it's what best fits the context of the Thessalonian church and the epistle, first epistle to the Thessalonians. Since these leaders, did not yet have a formal title, Paul describes them with a series of three participles, each of which describe a part of what these men do. English does not use participles in quite the same way that Greek does, and if you're confused by the technical terminology, don't worry about it. I'm just saying it for accuracy's sake. The series of three parallel participles in Greek are translated with three descriptive clauses into English. But the meaning is the same, and the structure of the passage remains clear. These are not three groups of men, each of whom have a different role to play, but one group of men who perform three different functions in the life of the church. He first describes them as those who labor, not just in general, but among you. While surely those whom Paul was asking the Thessalonians to acknowledge would not have been among the idle or unruly that he condemns both in this letter and in the one that follows, he is not here talking about their general diligence in the ordinary course of life. So in other words, those that he would have wanted to be the leaders of the church would have been those that were diligent in their ordinary course of life. But he's not referring to that ordinary course of life diligence in this verse right here. He is speaking of those who are putting forth diligence to meet the needs of the church. The labor that these leaders are engaged in is among the congregation. While the two descriptors that follow make it clear that Paul primarily has in mind those who are functioning as elders in the congregation. So he gives three descriptors of one group of people, one group of men, and it's clear if you take those three descriptors together that these men are filling the role and function of elders that he talks about so often in the pastoral epistles and in his other letters and that are mentioned in the book of Acts and throughout the New Testament as a whole. At the same time, I think it's important to point out that elders are not the only leaders who labor among you. The labor of faithful deacons also has a vital role to play in the health of the church. And not only faithful deacons, but there are leaders in the church who labor among the congregation who do not have a formal role or a formal title and yet play a vital part and function in the role and function of the local church. So when Paul says those who labor among you, he's not saying that only this group is the only one that is doing labor, but that the elders are among those who are laboring. Hope that makes sense. While the deacons primarily focus on the physical and administrative needs of the church, and the elders primarily give themselves to prayer and the ministry of the word, to teaching and counseling, both offices are concerned with labor among the congregation, and both deserve to be acknowledged because both are important. And I thank the Lord for the faithful deacons that the Lord has blessed us with, as well as the many faithful servants that labor for the sake of the Lord in this congregation, even apart from any formal role or office. Nevertheless, as vital as the labor of deacons is, it's not that labor that Paul has in mind primarily here, as is evidenced by his next description of the group of men he wants the Thessalonian church to acknowledge, those who are over you in the Lord. He next describes them as those who are over you in the Lord. In other words, those who lead the congregation, who have responsibility for the well-being of the congregation, and who preside over the assembly of the congregation. Whereas faithful labor in the Lord for the good of the congregation is common to both elders and deacons and other leaders besides, it is the role and function of elders to bear the responsibility of leading the congregation. At the same time, this leadership must always be in the Lord. There is no place in the life of the local church for petty authoritarianism that can take place. And that is something that Paul warns about and is warned about even in the book of Revelation. That's the most likely explanation of what the doctrine of the Nicolaitans was. People who were setting themselves up over the people of the Lord rather than leading them in the Lord. And we could go on about that, but we must move on. His final description of these leaders is those who admonish you. This is the hard one. The labor, as Paul later wrote to Timothy, of elders is primarily concerned with the word and doctrine, with teaching and equipping the saints of the church. That can be a source of controversy. It rarely is. Their leadership focuses on the activities and function of the congregation as a whole, particularly as gathered for worship. Again, that can sometimes be a source of controversy. But again, it normally isn't. Yet the elders of the church have more to do than to teach and lead. Important as those roles are, there is a third and equally vital function that the leaders of a properly functioning church must play, and that is to admonish the members. This means, as one lexicon put it, to counsel about an avoidance or cessation of an improper course of conduct. To counsel about avoidance or cessation of an improper course of conduct. The leaders of a properly functioning church are to be involved in the lives of the members of that church to such an extent that when one of those members begins in belief or practice to drift away from the truth, they are able to admonish them as pointedly as is necessary to change the direction they are headed in. While this admonition, if not heeded, can lead to a more formal process of church discipline, the point of it is to bring things to people's attention before it ever gets to that point, to warn them about problems in their life before the consequences of those problems are apparent to all. No group of leaders does this perfectly, any more than they preach perfect sermons or come up with perfectly structured worship services, as is evidenced by the need to sometimes change the order of the worship service. Yet when church is done God's way, these three functions, laboring, leading, and admonishing, will be at the core of what the leadership of the church is about. These are the things that the elders of the church are to be engaged in. There are many good things that the leaders of a church can do. There are many forms of labor they can be involved in, many different tasks they can perform. Yet in a church that is functioning as God intends the church to function, these are the things that are to be at the core of what the leadership is doing. Yet the responsibility of the church these are the things that the elders of the church are to be engaged in, yet the responsibility of the church to those men that engage in these tasks goes beyond formal acknowledgement. After his threefold description of the leaders that are to be acknowledged, Paul gives two more instructions as to how the congregation is to respond to them. So we've got first instruction to the congregation about leaders, three things that are to characterize the leaders, and then two more instructions to the congregation about how they are to respond to the leaders. So three words to the leaders, three words to the congregation. Paul instructs the congregation to esteem these leaders very highly in love for their work's sake. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on this, but if you look at what Paul has to say on the topic throughout his letters, you could summarize it under three basic headings. The elders of the church are to have their leadership followed so long as their conduct continues worthy of that leadership. They're to be provided for financially according to their needs and the ability of the church and the role that they have in terms of the leadership of the church, and to be protected from false accusations by the requirement of multiple witnesses before an accusation against them is to be received. The elders have a responsibility to admonish. Since not everyone likes to have their sin called out, that pretty much guarantees that there are going to be accusations against them. And these accusations are not to be received by others simply on the say-so of one disgruntled person, because then they would constantly have to deal with one disgruntled person at a time and would never be able to deal with the things that God's actually given them to do. Genuine misconduct by leadership must be dealt with with the utmost severity, as Paul reminds Timothy in the very same passage. But slanders that cannot be proven are to be ignored. This threefold esteem of the leaders of the church is to be for the sake of the work that they do. The city of Thessalonica was a very status-conscious place, and at least some of those who rose to leadership would have been of a higher social status than many of the members. The temptation would have been for the members to esteem them, not because of their labor in the ministry, but because of their position in society more generally, because of who their parents were, or perhaps because of the financial clout that they carried. Perhaps even looking down on those in leadership who did not have such advantages. There was, Paul insisted, to be none of that in the church of Thessalonica. To bring the discussion into our contemporary culture, church leaders are not to be given respect on the basis of who their parents were, or where they went to school, or even, and this is very important in our day and age, how naturally gifted they are, because there are certain churches and certain church cultures where certain leaders are set on a pedestal because they have some natural gift that may even be independent of any spiritual labor that they do, and they're given a pass for failing all the qualifications of leadership because they can bring people into the church through their natural gifting, and that is not at all what God had in mind for church leadership. It's their labor in the Lord for the local congregation, not how esteemed they are for some other reason because they're very eloquent speakers or because they have a lot of education. That's not to be the basis of the respect that leaders in the church receive. In short, any of the sorts of things that gain one respect in the outside world, they are to be respected and respectable in the outside world, but that is not to be the basis of their esteem in the congregation, but solely on the basis of their labor for the Lord in the local church that they lead. They're not to be too big for the local church. If they're too big for the local church, then they may just be too big for their own good. And we'll end that soapbox for now. The third instruction that Paul gives the congregation in relationship to their leaders is to be at peace among yourselves. And this may at first not seem to connect to how they respond to the leaders, but it actually does, because in addition to acknowledging them and esteeming them, the members of the church are to seek the unity of the congregation itself. And this connects to leadership in this way: it's impossible to lead a congregation if the members of that congregation are at war with one another, constantly trying to get the leadership to pick sides so as to get a one-up on their opponents. Not only that, but if the leadership is doing its job of admonishing those who need to adjust their course of action, there will, sad as it is to say, almost always be someone who has a chip on their shoulder that they want to share. While Paul beseeched the congregation to acknowledge and esteem their leaders, the instruction to be at peace among yourselves is a direct command, an imperative verb. In sum, then, when church is done God's way, the leaders of the church are to be those who are laboring, leading, and admonishing. The membership of the church is to respond by acknowledging, esteeming, and being at peace with their fellow members so that the leaders can focus on carrying out their God-given functions. Yet as Pastor Houston has preached so often, healthy ministry in the local church demands the involvement of more than the ministers. Paul goes on in his summary of how the local church is to operate. The words that are translated beseech and exhort are very similar in meaning. In fact, beseech in the King James far more often translates the second than the first, and there's a technical reason why the two are switched, but I won't give you that unless you're fascinated. You can ask me later. These two headings, in other words, are parallel each to the other. Under both headings, he is giving instructions to the congregation as to how God intends the church to function. Paul gave three descriptions of the role and function of the leadership, three instructions as to how the congregation is to respond to that leadership, and now he is going to give three basic instructions, followed by two clarifications that apply to all three of those instructions that are directed toward the one anothering ministry of the members, with two additional clarifications, as I said, that apply to those first three. First is, warn them that are unruly. The verb translated warn is the same one that is translated admonish when Paul was discussing the role of the leaders. While admonishing may be the particular responsibility of the leadership, it is in reality something that is to be engaged in by all the members of the church. Now, this is not talking about making a list of people you think are out of line and going to them in turn and reading them the riot act about how they need to get back in line. That is not what this is talking about. And if that is what you think this is talking about, you may need to look in the mirror for the top suspect on your list. It is about taking our responsibility as brothers and sisters in Christ to keep an eye on the conversation and conduct of each other, the way that we are walking both in the congregation and before the world as a whole. Since none of us have yet been perfected, and this is something that all of us, including the leaders, need on a regular basis. If someone says or does something that is out of line, the right response is not to go home and stew about it, and certainly not to complain to someone else about it, and not even to stew about it until you have a riot act against that person, and then you blow up at them, which does happen sometimes, but rather to go to that person in love and humility and admonish them for their fault, in kindness and patience and tenderness, not in, you need to change your course of action. Now, there may be some things where someone's behavior is so out of line that it's an immediate, you need to change right now or you're going to be in major trouble. There are some offenses that may call for that, but those are usually few and far between. And if someone, got hurt your feelings, that probably doesn't call for that kind of response. It is only if they, but rather to go to that person in love and humility and admonish them for their fault. Or say, brother, I think the course of action, I think the direction that you're headed in is going to be dangerous. You may not see that there's a temptation that's headed your way that you're not prepared for. And you may think you're ready for this road that you're on, but there's some dangers you need to pay attention to. Your spirit has changed in the past few weeks. Is there something going on? You've not been as faithful at church as you used to be. What's going on in your life? Or I noticed the way you responded to your children was really pretty harsh. You may need to have a spirit check on that, on the way that you're interacting with your kids. Or, is everything okay with you and your wife? Because you seem like you're just always on edge with each other. Maybe you need to get away and I'll watch your kids for a night so you can go on a date and spend some time together. That's the sort of thing that this is talking about. Admonishing one another over sins that seem small is the only way to keep those sins from producing the horribly destructive fruit that every sin left unchecked eventually produces. Yet if one anothering those that were out of line was all that there was to admonishing those that were out of line was all that there was to one anothering, the local church would be a rather cheerless place. The reality is far different. In fact, one of the very reasons that the unruly are to be warned is to clear some space for all the other sorts of one anothering that are to be going on. So we warn those that are unruly so that we can have the space and the peaceableness in the congregation to help everyone. Among those other types of one anothering is the command to comfort the feeble-minded. The term that is thus translated appears only here in the New Testament. A quite literal translation would be something like little-souled. The reference is not, however, to those whose mental faculties are weak or whose souls are small, whatever that might mean. It's a term that's used in the Greek Old Testament to refer to those who are discouraged and despondent, even to the point of being in anguish because of the difficulty of their circumstances. And there can be times when your circumstances are so difficult, perhaps because of your own sickness or that of someone in your family, because of grief over a loss, because of a grievous season of spiritual battle and temptation, or even from simple exhaustion brought on by overwork, that you literally have no strength of soul or mind left. Just as there are those in the congregation who need to be admonished, there are those in the congregation who would be destroyed by an admonishment. They don't need to be told to snap out of it. They need to be comforted. They need someone to weep with them, someone to encourage them, someone to help them get back on their feet. Giving them the encouragement that they need to stay faithful in a difficult season is part of the one anothering that Paul commands those congregations that seek to do church God's way to be involved in. The church is not to be the place you go only when you feel put together and have something to offer others. It is also to be a place of encouragement and comfort for those who feel like not only their world, but even their very inner being is falling apart from the inside out because of the difficulty of the circumstance that they're going through. A circumstance that may not even be apparent to others, but it is obvious in your own life. While almost everyone goes through seasons of difficulty, there are some believers whose weakness in the faith seems almost to be constitutional. For whatever reason, perhaps because of something that happened in their past, perhaps because of a limitation of some sort, they simply do not have the strength to stand on their own, and thanks be to God, they don't have to. While those that are weak may sometimes need to be admonished and sometimes need encouragement, what they need above everything else is the support of the community to keep them from turning to the right hand or to the left, to pick them up when they fall down, and to protect them from the wolves that love to look for easy prey. And by the way, Paul's attitude towards the weak in the congregation is very, very different from the attitude towards the weak, those that are unable to fend for themselves in Paul's culture or in our culture for that matter. Paul's attitude wasn't despise them and keep them in a lower place or we don't really want any of. In fact, this was actually an accusation that was made against Christianity that the pagan philosopher said, our philosophy is for the strong. And look at all the strong and amazing people that come and join our philosophy. And in your churches, you have all these weak people. You have these people that are no one else would want. And you welcome them into your church. And Paul would have said, if he had lived to hear the arguments of Mr. Celsus, who was the name of the person who said that, that's exactly the point. Because the cross celebrates, Jesus himself did not come in strength and power and might. He came in weakness and he died on the cross to be there, to be the support for the weak. And the congregation is not to despise those who perhaps struggle with weakness, but to strengthen and support and to stand around them so that they can keep in line with the rest of God's people, even if naturally they may not have the strength to do so. So the weak are to be supported. To come as no surprise that not everyone who needs such one anothering is going to be eager to receive it. The weak may not want to acknowledge how much support they really need. Just because someone is weak does not mean that they are aware of their weakness. They may think of themselves as quite strong, and they may demonstrate their weakness by needlessly admonishing those who are actually not at fault. That could be a way that they are weak, and that does happen. The despondent may, in their discouragement, lash out at those who try to help them. And the unruly are probably not going to love being admonished. The reality is that your one anothering is not always going to be received with joy, even by those, perhaps especially by those, who need it the most. Those you are trying to help are going to do and say things that will be hurtful, perhaps even devastating. It may be quite the process before you see any fruit from your investment in their lives, and there may be some situations in which you never do see progress in that particular person's life. Regardless of the kind of one anothering that is needed in a particular circumstance, patience is essential. While surely Paul would have desired patience toward everyone, the particular force of the all in this verse is to refer back to the three classes in need of one anothering he has just given. In other words, the members are to admonish the unruly, comfort the discouraged, support the weak, but be patient with all of them because all of these activities is going at one level or another to demand patience. The second clarification regarding the ministry of the members to one another is to see, to watch out, to give attention so as to ensure that evil is never rendered for evil. This is in context directly connected to the command to have patience in the preceding clause, which is itself directly connected to the three initial instructions on one anothering in the community. As you try to minister to others, there will be times when their response towards your efforts to help is to lash out at you, even intentionally so, to seek to do you harm because you tried to help. and you'll be tempted to respond with tit for tat, evil for evil. Yet no matter how badly you have been hurt, the response ought never to be to hurt someone else in exchange. No matter how provoking, even infuriating, someone is behaving or speaking, we are always to seek their good. And this applies to those that are outside the church as well as to those that are within it. While self-defense may be appropriate and even necessary at times, there is never, under any circumstances whatsoever, a time or a place for revenge in the life of the believer, either towards other believers or to those outside of the believing community. Vengeance belongs to the Lord alone. Paul began this passage by instructing the Thessalonians to know or acknowledge the leaders that God had given them, giving along the way a threefold summary of what the ministry of those leaders or ministers involved. Those that were thus acknowledged were to be esteemed for the sake of their work, and their work was to be made possible by the determined pursuit of peace among the membership. The members, for their part, were also to be engaged in ministry one to another, admonishing the unruly, comforting the discouraged, supporting the weak, patiently waiting to see what the fruit of their labor, and steadfastly refusing to repay evil for evil, no matter how great the provocation. To sum it up in one sentence, Paul told the Thessalonians that a healthy community demands the ministry of both ministers and members. Paul told the Thessalonians that a healthy community demands the ministry of both ministers and members. Though our circumstances are very different from those early believers in the city of Thessalonica, the basics of how God does church have not changed, and therefore there is much for us to learn from this passage. For the sake of time, I will not be giving a point-by-point application of all we've covered up to this point, much as I would like to. But I do want to show in conclusion just a few of the ways in which the truths found in this text have impacted and ought to continue to impact the way that we, quote, do church today. We are not a new church. In fact, as most of you know, we celebrated our 50th anniversary this past year. Yet even as a well-established church, we still have the need to acknowledge, to formally recognize those who are filling leadership roles. And this, as you may have noticed, is a process that is going on in our church even now. I'll not at this point say much more about it, but it's something that the Lord has been working in our church even over the past several months and over the several months that will continue moving forward. What I do want us to focus on is the role that every member of this church plays in God's plan for the local church. Ministers are needed, and Paul addresses that. But there is no way that the, quote, staff alone, no matter how many staff members we had, can do all of the ministering that God's plan for the local church involves. Involving and acknowledging other leaders who may or may not be on staff is an important step in the right direction. But God's plan for ministry involves more than formally appointed ministers, no matter how many of them there are, no matter how many appointed ministers we had, no matter how many names I put up on the website with a picture and a bio, those names are not going to accomplish all the ministry that needs to take place in this congregation. The way that God does church demands that every member be involved in ministry. If you are not at the point where you can minister to others, you need to be seeking out the ministry of others for the purpose of being strengthened, not simply to deal with your current crisis, important as that may be, but so that you yourself can turn around and minister to others. The way that God does church, there is no place for church membership that consists in nothing more than filling a chair and occasionally filling out an envelope. Though I'm thankful for our chairs and for the building that houses them, we could have a biblical church without either. I'm thankful for the funds that come in through the offerings. And though generosity, as Pastor Houston has been preaching, is essential to a healthy Christian life and to a healthy church life, biblical church life does not demand a particular annual budget. What it does demand is that every member be involved in the one anothering to which Paul exhorted the Thessalonians so many years ago. That was how God did church then, and it is still how he does it today. Healthy community demands the ministry of both ministers and members. How are you participating and contributing to that healthy community by your ministry? I'm going to go before the Lord in prayer, and after I'm done, we're going to have a time of invitation, and David's going to come and lead a hymn of invitation. And my encouragement would be, if the Lord has spoken to you, and if there's something in the message that you said, you know what, I could do better at that, or perhaps even a particular situation that there's someone you know that you need to admonish, and you've been putting it off. Or perhaps there is someone that you know needs comfort, and you've thought the situation maybe is too difficult and you don't want to be involved in it. There could be something particular or even just in general, a commitment in this new year to participate afresh in the ministry that ought to be taking place in the life of the local church. I know in my own life, even preparing this message, there have been a number of points at which I've been convicted of things that I need to do to better participate in that community. And I'm thankful for that. And now we'll have a time when you can come before the Lord as well. Father, I come before you. I thank you for your goodness. I thank you for your word. I thank you that the way that you do church works. It always has and it always will. It won't always be easy, but it will always be right. And I pray that we would come to reflect that plan more and more each week that we assemble together before your in your name, both in my own life and in the lives of everyone that is here. In Christ's precious name I pray. Amen.